Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 857, update on Ukraine, the Earth Island Boogie, and Team Snowden, unquote. This is being recorded on August 9th of the year 2015. This program is not only going to be updating, obviously, the ongoing crisis in Ukraine, but we are going to set developments that have been taking place with regard to Ukraine and Eastern Europe in a broader geopolitical context, looking at the conflict in terms of the Earth Island or World Island, as it is called. And we're also going to be taking a look once again at some of the links between fascist elements and intelligence connected elements that figure into the mix, so to speak, in Ukraine, with elements that are associated with everybody's favorite spy, Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden, a man I call the Peach Fuzz Fascist. I also call him the Obverse Oswald. Edward Snowden is a spy who is fronting for an extreme right-wing and fascist intelligence operation, and yet it is being maintained that it is something other than that. And we've spoken about Snowden at great length in the past. And we're going to be taking a look at Pierre Omidyar, who is bankrolling Glenn Greenwald's recent adventures. He also has been bankrolling efforts by Laura Poitras, another of the members of Team Snowden. Not only was Pierre Omidyar of eBay involved in financing the coup in Ukraine, he also now is teaming with an organization that probably has as flagrant an oxymoron as a title as one could have. That is the National Endowment for Democracy. That is basically an extension of the U.S. intelligence community and was involved with the Ukraine coup. And Pierre Omidyar, the savior of American journalism, is now putting together a fact-checking operation and is partnered in so doing with the National Endowment for Democracy. Again, a direct extension of the U.S. intelligence community and an institution that has been involved in, among other things, projecting outright fascist and Nazi elements into various parts of the world. In For the Record 848, Walking the Snake in the Baltic States, we reprised a section from AFA program number 36, done in the winter of 1991, talking about the NED, again, the National Endowment for Democracy, projecting World War II-era Lithuanian fascists back into Ukraine, back into Lithuania, where along with other Baltic fascists, they are now politically rehabilitating the Waffen-SS, making the Baltic states Waffen-SS formations to be, quote, anti-communist freedom fighters, unquote. And that is the nature of the organizations with which Mr. Wonderful Pierre Omidyar has partnered. We're also going to be taking a look at a recent arrest for apparently plotting a bomb attack of a seated member of Parliament of the Sweden Democrats, originally formed as a, quote, Nordic superiority party. The Sweden Democrats have been bankrolled to a considerable extent by Carl Lundström, a Swedish fascist who also provided most of the financing for the Pirate Bay media, or Pirate Bay website, from which WikiLeaks operated when it launched its operations. Carl Lundström is, a doctrinaire fascist. Members of his Swedish fascist milieu have actually embarked to Ukraine and are fighting with the notorious Nazi Azov battalion. Lundström, in addition to financing Pirate Bay, which hosted WikiLeaks, Lundström also, again, financed the Sweden Democrats. He also, at one point, arranged a Scandinavian speaking tour for David Duke. as we have looked at in a number of programs. Basically, the Snowden op is a direct extension of the WikiLeaks op. They are both intelligence operations. Snowden apparently went from Hawaii to Hong Kong, courtesy of Jacob Applebaum of WikiLeaks, and he went from Hong Kong to Russia, courtesy of Sarah Harrison and other WikiLeaks people. Basically, again, the Snowden operation is an extension of the WikiLeaks operation. Glenn Greenwald is in many ways joined at the hip with WikiLeaks. And again, WikiLeaks, in its inception, was holding forth on the Pirate Bay website, financed by Carl Lundstrom, who also finances the Sweden Democrats, a Swedish fascist party that has embraced the anti-immigrant theme so popular among European quote-unquote populist unquote parties. WikiLeaks came to be on the Pirate Bay website courtesy of a guy named Joran Jermas, J-E-R-M-A-S, who was handling WikiLeaks operations for Belarusia and Russia. His son, Johannes Wallström, is handling WikiLeaks operations for Scandinavia. Both Joran Jermas, a.k.a. Israel Shamir, unquote, and his son, Joran Jermas, are doctrinaire fascists and Holocaust deniers. Joran Jermas once opined that, quote, "It is the duty of all good Christians and Muslims to deny the Holocaust." And he was Julian Assange's right-hand man for a long time. And it was Joran Jermas, as we saw in For the Record 745, who arranged for WikiLeaks to hold forth on the Pirate Bay server that was financed by Carl Lundstrom. As we looked at in For the Record 853, and as we will review again today, the milieu of Joran Jermas heavily overlaps the milieu of MAUP. It's a Ukrainian acronym of M-A-U-P. It is the largest private university in Ukraine with some 50,000 some odd students. It is a doctrinaire, anti-Semitic, and fascist institution. And one of the people who teaches at the MAUP universities is none other than David Duke, the very same KKK leader for whom Carl Lundstrom arranged a Scandinavian speaking tour, and with which Joran Jermas is allied through a Russian fascist milieu with which he is heavily networked. So again, we're going to be taking a look at information about Ukraine, and yet we're going to be setting that in the context of the Earth Island and the context of the Snowden operation. The Earth Island, or World Island, as it is sometimes called, is a huge stretch of land running from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, most of the Middle East, Russia, India, Pakistan, and China. It contains most of the world's landmass. It has most of the world's population and most of the world's natural resources, including oil. If you control the Earth Island or World Island, geopoliticians have long felt that one could control the Earth itself. So this huge stretch of land is seen as the key to world domination. It should also be noted that stretching across the middle of that huge stretch of land is a swath of largely Muslim population. And for a long time, imperial aspirants or aspirants, primarily European but also now American, have seen controlling or using that Muslim population of the Earth Island as proxy warriors or proxy political operatives in order to gain control of the Earth Island and its vast resources. So that is what we're going to be looking at. And again, we're going to be peeking at Ukraine in conjunction with the Earth Island. And in that context, the battle, the combat in Ukraine has been joined by Chechen Muslims apparently associated with the Islamic State. That was discussed in the New York Times article and developed further by Robert Perry in his Consortium News website of July 7th of 2015. This article, Ukraine Merges Nazis and Islamists by Robert Perry, talks about three battalions of Chechen Muslims now fighting in Ukraine under the administrative command of Pravi Sektor. That is one of the OUNB heirs that has been governing Ukraine and, as we will see, has also been functioning as something of a loose cannon. Pravi Sektor and Dmytro Yarosh himself, a member of parliament and an advisor to the Ukrainian army, are indicating that they are dissatisfied with Ukrainian political leadership of Petro Poroshenko, and they are threatening to use arms against that government. And among the things that they are lobbying for is a declaration of war by Ukraine against Russia and against the ethnic Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine. That is more than a little problematic, aside from the fact that that might just lead to World War III. The IMF is readying a huge bailout package because Ukraine is an economic basket case. And if Ukraine formally declares war and is committed as a nation formally to war, they are not eligible for the IMF bailout. So right now, Pravi Sektor is proving to be something of an embarrassment of sorts, but not too much. Again, from Consortium News of July 7th of 2015, Ukraine merges Nazis and Islamists. This reads in part as follows. In a curiously upbeat account, the New York Times reports that Islamic militants have joined with Ukraine's far-right and Nazi battalions to fight ethnic Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine. It appears that no combination of violent extremists is too wretched to celebrate as long as they're killing Ruskies. The article by Andrew E. Kramer reports that there are now three Islamic battalions, quote, deployed to the hottest zones, unquote, such as around the port city of Mariupol. One of the battalions is headed by a former Chechen warlord who goes by the name Muslim, unquote, Kramer wrote, adding, quote, the Chechen commands the Sheikh Mansur group, that's M-A-N-S-U-R, named from 18th century Chechen resistance fighter. It is subordinate to the nationalist Right Sector, a Ukrainian militia. Right Sector, formed during last year's street protests in Kiev from a half dozen fringe Ukrainian nationalist groups like Whitehammer and the Trident of Stefan Bandera. Another, the Azov group, is openly Nazi, using the wolf's hook symbol associated with the Nazi SS. Without addressing the issue of the Nazi symbol, the Chechen said he got along well with the nationalists because, like him, they loved their homeland and hated the Russians, unquote. As casually as Kramer acknowledges the key frontline role of neo-Nazis and white supremacists fighting for the U.S.-backed Kiev regime, his article does mark an aberration for the Times and the rest of the mainstream U.S. news media, which usually dismiss any mention of this Nazi taint as, quote, Russian propaganda, unquote. Skipping down. Now, the Kiev regime has added to those forces of civilization resisting the Rusky barbarians Islamic militants with ties to terrorism. Last September, Marcin, M-A-R-C-A-N, Mamon, M-A-M-O-N, a reporter for The Intercept, reached a vanguard group of these Islamic fighters in Ukraine to the help of his, quote, contact in Turkey with the Islamic State, who told me his, quote, brothers, unquote, were in Ukraine, and I could trust them. The New Times article avoids delving into the terrorist connections of these Islamist fighters.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Well, in a number of shows, including For the Record 710, for the record, 720, and most recently in 773, dealing with the Boston Marathon bombing, we have looked at some indications that, in fact, Muslim Brotherhood-connected fighters have been used as proxy warriors in the Caucasus and specifically in Chechnya. And the former chief of Saudi intelligence, Prince Bandar, a.k.a. Bandar Bush, very, very close to the Bush family, admitted as much in the conversation with President Vladimir Putin. Basically, he said, yep, the Chechen fighters are controlled by us, and basically offered to call off the dogs, so to speak, with regard to the Winter Olympics in Sochi. He said he would guarantee the safety of the Sochi Olympics in exchange for certain concessions by President Putin. And Putin basically told him to plant it in his backyard. And so basically it now would appear that Saudi Arabia, and I think we can safely assume associated elements of U.S. intelligence and BND, are now helping the Islamic State allied Chechen fighters in Ukraine. It is extremely suspicious that three battalions of Chechen fighters would suddenly turn up in Ukraine, an area that is not overly sympathetic to Islamic fundamentalists, and are now fighting with the Nazi formations such as Province Sector and the Azov Battalion. And again, I think it is highly probable that the presence of the Chechen fighters in Ukraine is due to some sort of covert operation that is underway there. Indeed, when one looks at a map of Europe and of Eurasia, Ukraine is something of a gateway between Europe, or what is viewed as Europe, and what is viewed as part of Eurasia, Russia, and then when you go further in, of course, China as well. It was the Earth Island and Eurasia that dominated the conceptual thinking in a book that was authored by none other than Zbigniew Brzezinski. Brzezinski was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor. He is of Polish extraction, however, he is from a part of Poland that also has been part of Ukraine at various points in time. As we looked at in AFA program number 3, Zbigniew Brzezinski also is very closely allied not only with the elements of U.S. intelligence, as one would expect from a national security advisor, but he also has a long curriculum vitae stretching back to working with the Galen milieu, Reinhard Galen, the Nazi Eastern Front spy chief who jumped to the West and to the CIA and the Federal Republic with his entire Nazi organization, still basically clearing his actions with the Nazi high command, even when he was switching over to nominally at least working with the Americans. In a number of different programs, we specifically did 4 interviews with Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould about their book, Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. We did interviews in, for the record, 678, 680, 683, and 685. And one of the things that we spoke about with Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould was how the first Afghan war began. We were told that basically Russia, an expansionist, not Russia, but Soviet Union, invaded Afghanistan as part of a drive to gain control of the Middle East and the oil supplies of the Middle East. It eventually turned out that Zbigniew Brzezinski had worked out a program of covert operations specifically designed to provoke the Russians or the Soviets into invading Afghanistan, and that was then made out to be an act of Soviet expansionism. It should also be noted that one of the things that Brzezinski was promoting was basically a strategy of using Muslims inside of the former Soviet Union as combatants and agent provocateur. Specifically, Brzezinski's goal for dominating the Earth Island and denying Russia access to any place outside of its own borders was based on the stratagem of, in part, of using Islamists as proxy warriors. That was done to great effect in Afghanistan, where the U.S. and other Western intelligence agencies backed the Afghan Mujahideen. The elder George Bush, by the way, for whom CIA headquarters is named, was in charge of the Afghan Mujahideen support effort. And eventually, Muslim nationalities within the Soviet Union proper were enlisted as part of Brzezinski's destabilization effort. So we're going to revisit citizen Brzezinski, and we're going to take a look at his goals of, first of all, provoking the former Soviet Union into invading Afghanistan, and his view of Ukraine as fundamental to blocking Russia and surrounding Russia. And again, when we see Islamic State-affiliated Chechen Muslim fighting formations in Ukraine, fighting with Pravi Sektor and the Azov Battalion, that should set us to sniffing the air. Looming large in the background of this, all this dynamic also, is the corporatist economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood that makes it a very much endeared organization to the World Bank, the IMF, and other elements in the West. This article is from the Op-Ed News of June 4th of 2015. It's by, again, Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould, who, again, we did four interviews for the record, 678, 680, 683, and 685, about their book, Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. And part of that untold story was how the Soviet Union came to invade Afghanistan in the first place. Skipping down in the June 4th, 2015 op-ed news article by Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould. Speaking of Brzezinski, his 1997 book, The Grand Chessboard, American Primacy and Its Geostrategic Imperatives, lays out the blueprint for how American primacists should feel towards drawing Ukraine away from Russia because, quote, without Ukraine, Russia ceases to be a Eurasian empire, unquote. Brzezinski's obsession derives from British geographer Sir Halford, H-A-L-F-O-R-D, Mackinder, M-A-C-K-I-N-D-E-R's 1904 definition of the central eastern nations of Europe as the pivot area, unquote, whose geographic position made them, quote, the vital springboards for the attainment of continental domination, unquote. Whether anyone realizes it, the Obama administration's current campaign against Russia in Ukraine is of Mackinder's design brought forward by Brzezinski. To an expert like Stephen Cohen, the Obama administration's indictment of Russia over Ukraine, quote, doesn't correspond to the facts, and above all, it has no logic, unquote. But a look back 40 years reveals that a lot of Cold War thinking wasn't fact-based either, and it may now be instructed to look for answers to Washington's current dose of illogic in the covert origins of the U.S.-supported 1970s war for Afghanistan. As the first Americans to gain access to Kabul after the Soviet invasion for an American TV crew in 1981, we got a close-up look at the narrative supporting President Carter's, quote, greatest threat to peace since the Second World War, unquote, and it didn't hold up. What had been presented as an open and shut case of Soviet expansionism by Harvard professor Richard Pipes on the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour could just as easily have been defined as a defensive action within the Soviets' legitimate sphere of influence. By the way, I think the same thing would apply to Ukraine. When you put World War II-era Nazis such as the OUNB right on Russia's border, and when you have formations, as we will see, from within the Punisher battalions, openly threatening to attack Russia and burn Moscow, It should not come as a surprise when you say, well, Russia's massing troops and armor and artillery at their border. Well, there are forces that are openly threatening, as we will see, to attack Russia. And certainly, if something like this were happening to the U.S., we would not be standing for it, not one bloody bit. Returning once again to the Fitzgerald and Gould essay. What had been presented as an open and shut case of Soviet expansionism by Harvard professor Richard Pipes on the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour could just as easily have been defined as a defensive action within the Soviets' legitimate sphere of influence. 3 years earlier, Pipes' Team B Strategic Objectives panel had been accused of subverting the process of making national security estimates by inventing threats where they didn't exist and intentionally skewing its findings along ideological lines. Now, that ideology was being presented as fact by America's public broadcasting system. In 1983, we returned to Kabul with Harvard Negotiation Project Director Roger Fisher for ABC's Nightline. Our aim was to establish the credibility of the American claims. We discovered from high-level Soviet officials that the Kremlin wanted desperately to abandon the war, but that the Reagan administration was dragging its feet. From the moment they entered office, the Reagan administration demanded that the Soviets withdraw their forces, while at the same time keeping them pinned down through covert action so they couldn't leave. Though lacking in facts and dripping in right-wing ideology, this hypocritical campaign was embraced by the entire American political spectrum and left willfully unexamined by America's mainstream media. At a conference conducted by the Nobel Institute in 1995, a high-level group of former U.S. and Soviet officials faced off over the question, why did the Soviets invade Afghanistan? Former National Security Council member Dr. Gary Sick established that the U.S. had assigned Afghanistan to the Soviet sphere of influence years before the invasion. So why did the U.S. choose an ideologically biased position when there were any number of verifiable fact-based explanations for why the Soviets had invaded? The former CIA director Stansfield Turner's responsibility could only be located in the personality of one specific individual. Brzezinski's name comes up here every 5 minutes, but nobody has as yet mentioned that he is a Pole, Turner said. The fact that Brzezinski is a Pole, it seems to me, was terribly important, unquote. What Stansfield Turner was saying in 1995 was that Brzezinski's well-known hatred of Russia led him to take advantage of the Soviets' miscalculation. But it wasn't until the 1998 Nouvelle Observateur interview that Brzezinski boasted that he had provoked the invasion of Afghanistan by the Soviets by getting President Carter to authorize a presidential finding to intentionally suck the Soviets in 6 months before they even considered invading. Yet, despite Brzezinski's admission, Washington's entire political spectrum continued to embrace his original false narrative that the Soviets had embarked on a world conquest. For Brzezinski, getting the Soviets to invade Afghanistan was an opportunity to shift Washington toward an unrelenting hard line against the Soviet Union. By using covert action, he created the conditions needed to provoke a Soviet defensive response, which he then used as evidence of unrelenting Soviet expansion. However, once his exaggerations and lies about Soviet intentions became accepted, they found a home in America's imagination and never left. The Brzezinski-drafted Carter Doctrine put the U.S. into the Middle East with a rapid deployment force. China became engaged as a U.S. military ally, and détente with the Soviet Union was dead.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing in, but by no means exclusively, economic and financial matters.
The Reagan administration would soon advance on this agenda with a massive military buildup, as well as expanded covert actions inside the Soviet Union by the nationalities working group. And as is explained in a link to this, that was a group that saw stirring up ethnic Muslims of various ethnic nationalities within the former Soviet Union as a good way of destabilizing the Soviet Union proper. And I think it does not require a great leap of imagination to see the Chechen battalions now fighting alongside private sector and the Azov battalion in Ukraine as the direct evolutionary successors to this policy. Continuing, the Polish-born Brzezinski represented the ascendancy of a radical new breed of xenophobic Eastern and Central European intellectuals bent on holding Soviet American policy hostage to their pre-World War II world view. Brzezinski's early support for expanding NATO into Eastern Europe and Ukraine was opposed by 46 senior foreign policy advisors who referred to it in a letter to President Clinton as, quote, a policy error of historic proportions, unquote. Yet in 1999, the Clinton administration, urged on by what Time magazine described as, quote, ethnic lobbying groups such as the Polish American Congress, unquote, began implementing the plan. U.S. policy since that time has operated in a delusion of triumphalism that both provokes international incidents and then capitalizes on the chaos. A destabilizing strategy of sanctions against Russia, the American military's training of the Ukrainian National Guard, more about that in a minute, U.S. troops parading armored vehicles within 300 yards of Russia's border, and warlike statements by NATO leaders can only mean that the U.S. is committed to Brzezinski's strategy of seizing the pivot area, unquote, and holding it. Today, it is Brzezinski's son, Ian Brzezinski, who finds Moscow at the root of America's problems regardless of the facts. He recently recommended to the Senate Armed Services Committee that the authority to make war on Russia should be taken out of President Obama's hands and given to NATO's top commander, General Philip Breedlove, a man accused by the German government of exaggerating the Russian threat in eastern Ukraine by spreading, quote, dangerous propaganda, unquote. And I think, again, looking at that statement by Brzezinski's son, that war-making powers with regard to Russia should be taken out of the president's hands, and that basically the NATO commander should be given power to initiate war with Russia, which parenthetically would result in a Third World War and the deaths of all of us either doing or participating in or listening to this program. Well, I think that is an indication of just how at one level extreme and at another level utterly fantastic the rhetoric and the thinking, if one could call that, behind it has come to be. I think that is a very important article by Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould. We will be interviewing them at some point in the not too distant future and talking more about that. I do think that it is important to see not just Brzezinski's ideological and strategic footprints in both Ukraine and in Afghanistan and in the Caucasus, but beyond that, looking at the view of the World Island and the Nazi and Galen legacy of American foreign policy and the influence on American foreign policy of organizations like the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, the former World Anti-Communist League, and the heir to the Promethean Network and the Promethean League that we spoke about in AFA 14 and in For the Record 824, among other programs. Now, in the op-ed news article that I was just reading, you heard a reference to the U.S. training the Ukrainian National Guard. There are, as of this time, elements of the 173rd Airborne Brigade in Ukraine training the Ukrainian National Guard. Now, the Nazi formations like Azov Battalion, Pravi Sektor, and others are part of the Ukrainian National Guard. They also are under the administrative command of the Interior Ministry of Ukraine. When it began to leak out, in spite of the Orwellian nature of American journalistic coverage, when it began to leak out that, in fact, many of the fighting formations that we were backing in Ukraine were Nazi, Patrick Leahy, the U.S. Senator from Vermont and others, basically implemented a piece of legislation barring the U.S. from training neo-Nazis. However, it would appear that Mr. Leahy's and John Conyers' good intentions notwithstanding, that, in fact, the American training of Nazi combatants in Ukraine is, in fact, taking place. And part of the reason for that is that the American overseers from the 173rd Airborne Brigade and others are basically screening potential military trainees from Ukraine for records of human rights abuses. They are not being screened for ideology. So if, in fact, a Ukrainian Nazi has not committed, as a matter of public record, a gross human rights violation, they would not be barred from training, which not only disregards whether or not that potential trainee is a Nazi, but also overlooks the obvious fact that despite the egregious perpetration of atrocities in the Ukraine civil war by many of these Nazi punisher battalions, as they are called, the people who have done this, and indeed the institutions themselves, and the Ukrainian government, and its amen chorus in the U.S. government and media, are not admitting to these human rights abuses. So it is something of a hermetic feedback loop, and because it is the Ukrainian Interior Ministry that is vetting the potential trainees, and it is that very same Ukrainian Interior Ministry that formed and supervises the Azov Battalion, private sector, and others, essentially it's business as usual in Ukraine. And although officially we are not training Azov Battalion members, in fact, because the selection of potential trainees is being done by the Ukrainian Interior Ministry, and because the Interior Ministry is in charge of the Punisher Battalions, they are the ones who are vetting the trainees, and surprise, surprise, Nazis have been among those trainees. An article in the Daily Beast of July 4th of 2015 by Will Cathcart, C-A-T-H-C-A-R-T, and Joseph Epstein, E-P-S-T-E-I-N, is America training neo-Nazis in Ukraine. There are no doubts about the neo-Nazi and white supremacist background of the Azov Battalion, a militia that has positioned itself at the forefront of the fight against Russian-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine. As the founder and head of the battalion, Andrei Beletsky, once put it, quote, "The historic mission of our nation in this critical moment is to lead the white races of the world in a final crusade for their survival," unquote. Skipping down. What is the relationship of the U.S. government to these people? Is it training them? Might it arm them? Is this like the Afghan War of the 1980s, one of those cases where we aid and abet the kind of monsters who eventually become our enemies? Concerns about that possibility have been growing on Capitol Hill. Because of uncertainty surrounding the Azov Battalion's role in the U.S. training initiative and worries about the possible supply of shoulder-held anti-aircraft missiles to such characters, the House unanimously adopted bipartisan amendments to H.R. 2685, the Department of Defense Appropriations Act of 2015, and one of them specifically blocked training of the, quote, Ukrainian neo-Nazi paramilitary militia Azov Battalion. And Representative John Conyers and Ted Yoho sponsored the amendment to the bill. Skipping down again, this is in addition to criteria established in an amendment to the Foreign Assistance Act of 1961, originally sponsored by Senator Patrick Leahy, known as the Leahy Vetting Process. The Leahy process consists of screening foreign forces applying for U.S. government training and support to certify that they haven't committed any, quote, gross human rights violations, unquote, skipping down again. But the highly problematic truth is that the U.S. currently has no real way of ensuring that members of neo-Nazi groups like the Azov Battalion are not being trained by U.S. forces because most, if not all, had not committed a, quote, gross human rights violation. Even more difficult to determine is whether ex-U.S. military are training crypto-Nazis in a private capacity. And the issue speaks volumes about the complexities that have to be confronted by the U.S. in its efforts to help Ukraine defend itself from Russian-supported secessionists. In an interview by the Daily Beast, Ivan Kharkov of the Azov Battalion talks about his battalion's experience with U.S. trainers and U.S. volunteers quite fondly, even mentioning U.S. volunteer engineers and medics that are still currently assisting the Azov Battalion. He also talks about the significant and active support from the Ukrainian diaspora in the U.S. As for the training they have and continue to receive from numerous foreign forces, the Azov Battalion's Kharkov says, "We must take knowledge from all armies. We pay for our mistakes with our lives," unquote. Skipping down further, Chief of the Office of Defense Cooperation for the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine, Colonel Cynthia Matuskovich, also denies that U.S. forces are training anyone from the Azov Battalion. Colonel Matuskovich says, quote, "The Ukrainian National Guard has told us there are none and that they all went through the normal vetting process that we're required to do by the State Department." When asked for specifics on the vetting process, she says, "Essentially, in its nearest sense, it's like background checks on individuals. I can't really elaborate, but we check with various agencies, including the consular section, and they just kind of do background checks. I can't personally say what happens in D.C. because I've never been on that end of the process, but the State Department in D.C. is the ultimate clearer, if you want to call it that." When asked how the Leahy process weeds out Azov members, for instance, those who have not committed gross human rights violations but identify themselves with the Nazis and even the SS, Matuskovich explains, "Unfortunately, I can't comment anymore. I mean, we have Leahy requirements and we ask for human rights vetting, but I mean, we don't individually interview everyone and ask them what their individual philosophies are, because we know people could lie. But we do our utmost to abide by the Leahy vetting, and we work with partners that you know we trust and have told us that none of them are members of those organizations." Of course, they wouldn't lie about that. As for the, quote, partners, unquote, they work with, Matuskevich says that they work directly with the Ukrainian National Guard, quote, "which coordinates all the trainees. They fall under the Ministry of Interior, so our political section at the embassy would be the ones who are dealing with them. The Ukrainian government, and I guess it's in the form of the Ministry of Interior, are the ones that nominate the candidates for the training." Well, the Azov Battalion and the other Punisher battalions were formed under the auspices of the Interior Ministry of Ukraine. So essentially, the official disclaimers are essentially worthless. I would also note that it was the State Department and Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland and the U.S. Embassy, as well as USAID, and the National Endowment for Democracy that were involved in helping to precipitate the Ukraine coup from the beginning. And I will also note, again, as we're told about Russian expansionism and so forth, and we're routinely told about Russian forces massing on the Ukraine border, this supposedly indicating an impending Russian invasion. Actually, something else may be going on.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site also features many articles not included in programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
As we have seen in past programs, such as For the Record 781 and others, and as we are going to see again, some of these very same Punisher or Volunteer battalions with an overt fascist and Nazi political outlook are openly threatening, well, I guess you could call it sedition against the Poroshenko government, and they are threatening violence against Russia and are threatening to attack Russia. Just imagine if military formations on the American border were making statements about this, about America. This is a Reuters story from July 29th of 2015 by Elizabeth Piper, P-I-P-E-R, and Sergey Karazy, K-A-R-A-Z-Y. Special report, Ukraine struggles to control Maverick battalions, and it reads in part as follows. This, by the way, is Dmytro Korshinsky, K-O-R-C-H-Y-N-S-K-Y. Dressed in a colorful peasant-style shirt, Korshinsky told Reuters that he follows orders from the Interior Ministry and that his battalion would stop fighting if commanded to do so. Yet he added, quote, "We would proceed with our own methods of action independently from state structures," unquote. Well, what might that action be, do you say? Korshinsky, a former leader of an ultra-nationalist party and a devout Orthodox Christian, wants to create a Christian Taliban to reclaim eastern Ukraine, as well as Crimea, which was annexed by Russia in 2014. He isn't going to give up his quest lightly. Quote, "I would like Ukraine to lead the Crusades," said Korshinsky, whose battalion's name is St. Mary. "Our mission is not only to kick out the occupiers, but also revenge. Moscow must burn," unquote. I suspect that talk like that coming from against some of the fascist fighting formations that are under the control of the Interior Ministry, I suspect that wouldn't sit real well with people in Russia. Again, imagine the reaction in this country if paramilitary fighting formations, being trained, by the way, by Russia, were making statements like this, you know, "Our mission is not only to kick out the occupiers, but also revenge. Washington must burn, or Chicago must burn, or New York must burn." This would not go well in the U.S. And it's amazing to watch these kinds of statements being issued. And also bear in mind that we've got people like Ian Brzezinski, Zbigniew Brzezinski's son, saying that war-making powers vis-a-vis Ukraine or vis-a-vis Russia should be taken out of the hands of the president and given to the military commander of NATO. And skipping down still further, more about the far right in Ukraine and some of the problems that they are causing for the government. Again, I think that there is some journalistic spin, which is actually using the overt and strident Nazi sympathies of organizations like Azov and Pravi Sektor and others to somehow portray the government in Kiev as legitimate or democratic or moderate. In fact, the ones in the suits in Kiev are simply the ones who are giving the marching orders to the people in the Punisher battalions. However, the Punisher battalions are not sharing in the loot. We've looked at in the past a charge by U.S. financial overseers that Arseniy Yatsenyuk, the Prime Minister of Ukraine, or Yats, as he was called by Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland, is suspected of embezzling $357 million from the cash-strapped Ukrainian government or Ukrainian treasury. Pravi Sektor is, and other Punisher battalions are using the ongoing corruption in Ukraine as justification for pursuing their agenda. And one of the problems with what they are saying is they're one of the things which they disagree is the failure on the part of the Kiev government to declare war. That is discussed in, among other articles, an EU Observer article of July 24th of 2015. It's by Alina Polyakova. Kiev's far-right problem. And it discusses, skipping down, in the most direct challenge with Kiev's government, right sector, or Pravi sector, announced that it will begin organizing a national referendum on the population's distrust of Ukraine's parliament, cabinet, and the president. Skipping down. Yarosh refused to give up his seat in parliament, but claimed that right sector, which is both a political party and a paramilitary organization, would not participate in the local elections in October. And then it talks about how badly off Ukraine is from an economics standpoint, skipping down, and talking about Poroshenko's unwillingness to formally declare war. The government has a legitimate reason for this ambiguity. Calling the conflict a war would cut off Ukraine from much-needed financial assistance from international lending agencies such as the International Monetary Fund, which do not provide assistance to countries at war. And again, private sector and others are pushing for a declaration of war, which would preclude the IMF giving a badly needed multi-billion-dollar infusion of aid to the cash-strapped Ukraine. By the way, private sector aren't the only people that are experiencing disillusion with what's going on in Ukraine. The Global Post of July 27th of 2015 has an article by Dan Pelyschuk, P-E-L-E-S-C-H-U-K. This crazy Ukrainian election shows the country has a ways to go toward reform. And skipping down, they talk about apparently disabled people being bribed to go out and cast votes and various other corrupt tactics, and this apparently has not gone over well. And by the way, the entire articles that I have excerpted are in the description for the record 857, which will be published shortly after the recording. To give you an idea of just how well things are going over with sort of the Ukrainian man or woman in the street. Many locals, meanwhile, appeared either too uninterested or exhausted with the campaign to come out to vote. There was a 35% turnout, and city streets were noticeably empty. So if the government in Kiev is going to fire up the population or the enthusiasm of the population, they have got a ways to go. Now, again, one of the points that I have made in connection with Ukraine is that, in my opinion, the operation, the intelligence operation for which Edward Snowden is fronting, was intended to do a number of things, including drive the final nail into President Obama's reboot with Russia, although it now seems to be ancient history. When Barack Obama came into office, one of his foreign policy priorities was rebooting relations with Russia, getting relations with Russia on a better footing. Well, that is now dead as a doornail, and the Snowden operation was sort of the last nail in the coffin of that policy element. And we've also noted that in connection with the Azov Battalion that Swedish military veterans, including Swedish fascists who had served as snipers in the Swedish army, were fighting with the Azov Battalion. And one of the things we've noted is the continuity between the WikiLeaks operation and the Snowden operation. The Pirate Bay website that was financed by Carl Lundstrom, a Swedish fascist, was the original website on which WikiLeaks held forth. And in addition to financing the Pirate Bay website, Carl Lundstrom also financed the Sweden Democrat Party. And this past week, a seated member of parliament of the Carl Lundstrom-financed Sweden Democrat Party was arrested and under suspicion of participating in a bomb plot. The Scotsman of July 22nd of 2015 has an article by Dominic Hind, H-I-N-D-E, Swedish far-right politician, unquote, implicated in bomb raid, unquote. And it reads in part, an elected member of Sweden's far-right Democrat Party has been implicated in a plot to obtain large amounts of high explosives with the potential for use in terror attacks. The local politician, who cannot be named for legal reasons, was detained along with three other men over the weekend in the Swedish province of Halland, H-A-L-L-A-N-D. One of the people arrested with him was a 30-year-old man, skipping down. The 30-year-old man had previously been convicted for attacking a foreign-born neighbor with an axe and was found to be in possession of pictures of Hitler, German war memorabilia, and Nazi SS flags by police who searched his home. Skipping down again. We have found signs that he had Nazi sympathies, added Nyman with regards to the 30-year-old suspect. There are objects and symbols which you would link to ideological extremism, unquote. The Sweden Democrat Party, who share a European Parliament group with UKIP and strongly oppose immigration, feminism, and multiculturalism, and are currently the third biggest party, in Sweden. Until the mid-1990s, members would regularly wear military-style uniforms at meetings, and two of their senior parliamentary deputies were involved in a drunken attack on the Swedish-Kurdish comedian Soren Ismail with a piece of scaffolding in 2010. And as it is made out here, the party was originally formed as a Nordic superiority party. Basically, it was an openly Nazi and fascist party. Founded as part of the Nordic White Power movement in 1988, the Sweden Democrats had been forced to expel several members over allegations of racism and extremism. Two other articles that I discussed in For the Record program number 853. Organized Anti-Semitism in Contemporary Ukraine by Per-Anders Rudling talks about the mob group in Ukraine and Julian Assange's right-hand man. Joran Jermas is an associate of that group. David Duke lectures at that organization. And although we haven't got time to read it, what is included in the description for the record 857 in its entirety, What Pierre Did Next by Mark Ames of Pandovaley of July 31st of 2015. Again, Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras's financial angel, Pierre Omidyar of eBay, helped to finance the Ukrainian coup, also the election of Narendra Modi, the Hindu fascist nationalist who is now president of India, and has also, that is to say, Pierre Omidyar, has also bankrolled Ukrainian MPs, as well as having financed the original coup in Ukraine. Now, reading the skipping down, I can't think of another media tycoon who co-funded a pro-U.S. regime change with American intelligence cutouts like USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy. One of the points that Mark Ames makes here is that in addition to continuing to fund Ukrainian media, Pierre Omidyar is partnering with the National Endowment for Democracy. This week, Omidyar Network announced yet another partnership with the National Endowment for Democracy and Poynter Institute to create an international online fact-checking hub. The point being that Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras' financial angel is more or less formally allied with U.S. intelligence. And that, again, that entire article is in the description for the record 857. This concludes For the Record 857, update on Ukraine, the Earth Island Boogie, and Team Snowden. This is being recorded on August 9th of the year 2015. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.